Welcome to tonight's program. My name is Mike Malloy. Thanks for tuning in. Rick Santorum's hypocrisy is starting to get to the point where, as we used to say when we were kids, it's enough to gag a maggot. We'll get to that a little bit later tonight. I try to stay away from this creep show of these Republicans, but Santorum is just a little bit too much, I swear to God. This hour is being sponsored by Diana in Florida. Thank you, Diana. Her message, it is class warfare, and the rich have been waging it against us since the beginning of civilization, always forgetting the danger that we vastly outnumber them. Thanks to Diana in Florida, who, by the way, has been a listener to this program, if I'm not mistaken, for probably over around a decade, a long time. Thanks, Diana, for the sponsorship. I appreciate it very much. Also, if I didn't mention, I want to welcome Columbus, Ohio, WVKO, 1580 AM, Cleveland, Ohio, WABQ, 1460, and Palm Springs, California, KPTR, 1450 on the dial. You lose one, you gain a few more. All right, I'm going to tell you about somebody's death, and this ties into what Barack Obama did on New Year's Eve directly. I know Bruce Enberg would say, no, it doesn't, but yes, it does, Bruce. A man died Monday in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. His name was Gordon Hirabayashi. Now, who in the world is Gordon Hirabayashi, right? Well, let me give you a little background. He was 93 when he died, by the way. He was imprisoned for defying the federal government, our federal government's internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And 40 years later, his conviction was overturned. He died, according to his son, of Alzheimer's. And again, he was 93. When Mr. Hirabayashi challenged the wartime removal of more than 100,000 Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants from the U.S. West Coast to inland detention centers, he became what the New York Times calls a central figure in a controversy that resonated long after the war's end. Mr. Hirabayashi and his fellow Japanese Americans, two people, Fred Korematsu and Minoru Yasui, all brought lawsuits before the U.S. Supreme Court, and they emerged as symbols of protest against unchecked government powers in a time of war. Are you beginning to get the connection? Mr. Hirabayashi told the New York Times in 1985, when he was fighting to have his conviction vacated, he said, quote, I want vindication not only for myself, I also want the cloud removed from over the heads of 120,000 other Americans. My citizenship didn't protect me one bit. Our Constitution was reduced to a scrap of paper, end quote. Starting to get the connection, are you? In February 1942, 2 months after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt, in the name of protecting the nation against espionage and sabotage, he didn't mention terrorism all those years ago, 69 years ago, but Roosevelt authorized the designation of areas from which anyone could be excluded. Anyone. 1 month later, a curfew was imposed along the West Coast on people of Japanese ancestry. And in May of 1942, the West Coast Military Command ordered their removal to inland camps in what was harsh and isolated terrain. Gordon Hirabayashi was the son of Japanese immigrants. He was a senior at the University of Washington when the United States entered World War II. He followed the pacifist principles of his parents, who had once belonged to a Japanese religious sect similar to the Quakers. When the West Coast curfew was imposed, ordering people of Japanese background to be home by 8 p.m., Mr. Hirabayashi ignored it. When the internment directive was put in place, he refused to register at a processing center, and he was jailed. He contended that the U.S. government's actions were racially discriminatory, and Mr. Hirabayashi proved unyielding. He refused to post $500 bail because he would have been transferred to an internment camp while awaiting trial. So he remained in jail from May of 1942 until October of that year, when his case was heard before a federal jury in Seattle, Washington. His appeal, along with one by Mr. Yasui, a lawyer from Hood River, Oregon, who had been jailed for 9 months for curfew defiance, made its way to the Supreme Court. And in 1943, ruling unanimously, the court upheld the curfew as a constitutional exercise of the government's war powers. Mr. Hirabayashi served out his 3-month prison term at a work camp near Tucson. Now, keep in mind, this is an American citizen, right? This is an American citizen. Mr. Hirabayashi later spent a year in federal prison for refusing induction into the armed forces, and he contended that a questionnaire sent to Japanese Americans by officials who were conducting the draft back then demanded a renunciation of any allegiance to the Emperor of Japan. And Mr. Hirabayashi said this was a racially discriminatory requirement because other ethnic groups were not asked about adherence to foreign leaders. Just the Americans of Japanese descent. These were Americans. Now, the cases of Mr. Hirabayashi, Mr. Yasui, and Mr. Korematsu, all these cases were revisited in the 1980s after a professor of political science, University of California, San Diego, found documents indicating that the U.S. federal government, when they argued before the Supreme Court, had suppressed its own finding that Japanese Americans on the West Coast were not, in fact, threats to national security. So in September 1987, 45 years later, a 3-member panel of a federal appeals court in San Francisco unanimously overturned Mr. Hirabayashi's conviction for failing to register for evacuation to an internment camp and for ignoring a curfew. The convictions of Mr. Korematsu and Mr. Yasui had been overturned earlier. And then in 1988, federal legislation provided for payments and apologies to Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II. Gordon Hirabayashi was born April 23, 1918, in Seattle, Washington, USA. His father operated a fruit and vegetable stand. Now, after the war, and after he was released from an internment camp, Mr. Hirabayashi graduated from the University of Washington, received a master's and a doctorate there in sociology. He taught at the American University in Beirut, the American University in Cairo, and in Canada at the University of Alberton in Edmonton, where he lived. He said in a book that he wrote, "When my case was before the Supreme Court in 1943, I fully expected that as a citizen, the Constitution would protect me. Surprisingly, even though I lost, I did not abandon my beliefs and my values. And I never look at my case as just my own or just as a Japanese-American case. It is an American case with principles that affect the fundamental human rights of all Americans." End quote. On December 31st, a few days ago, Barack Obama signed a law abrogating those rights.
should be like that.
Entering a flying monkey free zone, it's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour, President Obama today made a recess appointment. The guy's name is Richard Cordray. He's a former Ohio Attorney General. He has been appointed to lead the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the one that Elizabeth Warren worked on for a considerable amount of time, and whom most progressives, most people who still believe in this country, however frayed that belief may be, thought that she would become the director. But because the Republicans put up so much resistance, not only to her, but the whole idea that there should be an agency to protect consumers. How ridiculous, how communist is that, right? So she bowed out, and she is going to be the next senator, one of the senators from Massachusetts, who defeat Scott Brown this November. Anyway, Obama went ahead and did a recess appointment immediately. This filthy little Republican Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, started screaming and frothing at the mouth for making what he called, what McConnell called, an unprecedented recess appointment. You see, there's some tradition, I guess, according to McConnell, that presidents make such appointments only when the Senate is in recess for 10 days or longer. So McConnell, this slimy little bastard McConnell, who should be screaming bloody murder about the fact that Obama signed into law the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, whatever it's called, that the slimy little bastard from Kentucky voted for. No, he wouldn't scream about that. He screams about this. McConnell said the following. Talk about hyperbole and the kind of slime that comes from this little cretin's mouth. He said, breaking from his precedent, from this precedent lands this appointee in uncertain legal territory, threatens the confirmation process, and fundamentally endangers the Congress's role in providing a check on the excesses of the executive branch, end quote. Now, that's McConnell, who had just how long ago was it when this slimy bastard voted for unlimited presidential power with the NDAA? See how the scum operate. As much as I am shattered and disappointed, my fault, in Obama, these Republicans are like something that slithers out from under a rock or a log that's been on the floor of the forest for about 8 months. It's horrible, these people. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was created by the Financial Services Overhaul Law that was passed in 2010. It was created by Christopher Dodd and Barney Frank. And it's designed to serve as the people's cop against deceptive, abusive, and predatory loan products in the financial marketplace. So naturally, Republicans are going to be against it. Naturally, they are. Of course. What? Eliminate deceptive, abusive, and predatory loan practices? Well, that's socialism. God, I hate these people. Republicans, of course, have said no about this agency from the very start. You know what their argument was? They have two arguments. That anything Obama does is either going to encourage terrorism or is going to hamper economic growth, right? Those are the only two things. This is supposed to hamper job growth, economic growth. You see? House Speaker John Boehner, in a statement, said that this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, quote, is bad for jobs and bad for the economy. Now, can I go get a drink? Bad for jobs and bad for the economy. A Consumer Protection Bureau. You sons of bitches. Oh, my God. Oh! So at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau website today, Richard Cordray issued a statement. You know, he said the usual stuff. Today I was appointed by President Obama, blah, blah, blah. But into a statement, he says things like, I've seen senior citizens lose their life savings to scams and fraud. I've seen young adults start their lives with crushing student loan debt burdens that they can't afford. I've seen families bankrupted and thrown out of their homes by complex mortgages with spiraling interest costs and monthly payments that were never clearly explained. That's the kind of thing that Cordray is going to guard against. And that's the kind of thing that the Republicans want to see continue. Because they are filthy. Republicans are in office for one purpose, to thoroughly destroy. There's still shreds and shards of the middle class left. And this is just gnawing at them. They can't stand it. A little bit more on this when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malone. I know I'm screaming already. I don't give a damn.
Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
25 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Diana in Florida, one of the original, I think, listeners to the Malloy program. She's been a supporter one way or another of this program for so long. Her message, it is class warfare, and the rich have been waging it against us since the beginning of civilization, always forgetting the danger that we vastly outnumber them. Indeed. Thanks, Diana. So, Richard Cordray, recess appointment by Barack Obama today. He is the new head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, whose job is going to be to ride herd on the financial services industry, which is arguably one of the most corrupt in the history of the human race. Even more so, and this is really, really saying something, more so than the weapons industry, the national security state industry. When you get down, because the financial services industry is at the very heart, the soul, the inner core of capitalism. And capitalism is a filthy, brutal, bloody, cut no one any quarter enterprise on a good day, on a bad day. Well, you know what happens on a bad day. We're living through it. And we've lived through it how many times in this country? But we don't learn.
Oh, no, let's go on with capitalism. That's really just a wonderful system.
Cordray says at the statement at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau website, he said, we have worked on a campaign to improve disclosures when people borrow money, to make the costs, risks, and benefits of financial transactions easier for consumers to understand. We've also launched our bank supervision program. you're gonna need people with weapons for that one, Richard, but that's all right. Anyway, CFPB, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, examiners are now on the ground at the nation's largest financial institutions, he writes, reviewing documents, asking tough questions about how these banks are complying with consumer financial protection laws. And it's right there that that is the reason that the Republicans do not want this bureau and certainly don't want Cordray and refuse to confirm him. Well, Obama made the move of a recess appointment, so the guy's in there for the next 2 years. Cordray goes on to say, one difficulty we faced until now was that without a director, that's his job now, we were unable to address all the problems we were created to tackle. In particular, we lacked the ability to supervise financial institutions other than big banks, like non-bank mortgage lenders and servicers and payday lenders. Is there more of a blood-sucking operation than these so-called payday lenders? Huh? Is there? There are so many of them here in the state of Georgia, and they cluster around military reservations, around military bases, that the Georgia General Assembly here has tried many times to regulate these this filth, and they've been unable to do so effectively. And my fear, and it's a legitimate fear, is that someday we're going to read about a soldier home on leave or whatever opens fire inside one of these rip-off places and wipes out four or five people working at these payday lender operations because they loan money. They entice servicemen or servicewomen in. They make the loan to them. And God forbid that this member of the military should fall behind because then their base commander is notified and all kinds of hell can break loose. So it's going to happen. Mark my words. It will happen eventually. What Richard Cordray and the CFPB will try to do is to regulate these sons of bitches, hopefully out of business. And don't give me arguments about they provide a service. No, they don't. They are bloodsuckers. They are leeches. They are capitalists. Anyway, he says that many of these institutions had no regular federal oversight in the run-up to the financial crisis. They led a race to the bottom that pushed aside responsible businesses, including community banks and credit unions, and greatly harmed consumers. And he closes by saying, I am pleased to say that we will now be able to exercise the full authorities granted to us under the law and begin to supervise these non-banks and other institutions as well. But this is the sort of thing that Republicans cannot stand. This is where they start screaming about, oh, well, Obama exceeded his authority. With this? I mean, if you hypocritical, filthy Republicans want to scream about somebody exceeding their authority, talk about the NDAA that all of you signed off on and that Obama signed into a law on New Year's Eve Day. Why don't you go there, Mitch McConnell, you swine? Nah. To the capitalists, that bill was a good one. To the capitalists, this bill is a bad one. You see how they make the qualitative difference, right? Of course you do. I got an email here that I want to share with you. This is from Kathy in Kauai. That's Hawaii, right? Mike, when I was a little kid in Michigan, I used to go outside in the dead of winter to breathe hard into the cold air. I'd breathe hard thinking that my warm breath would bring on spring a little bit sooner. Every little bit helped, I believed that. When I divorced my right-wing Republican Catholic husband, his parting words were, you're insanely optimistic. I paused, gave it thought, and then took that as a compliment. I was right there only weeks ago, involved in the ground floor of launching Occupy Santa Cruz, California. It was a beautiful movement, which energized intelligent people. I felt empowered to be a part of it. I do think Occupy was successful in making people aware of the language of 1%, 99%, and making people aware of anything these days is a big accomplishment. I bought several copies of Vulture's Picnic to send to friends for holiday gifts. I admire the Greg Palast and Michael Moores, Amy Goodmans of our world. This one insanely optimistic woman, however, is taking pause. My brother has recently taken a job as a CNA. I guess that's a certified nursing assistant at a nursing home in Alabama. He tells me stories of the cruelty that he has witnessed in the nursing home setting where he works. The total ignorance and lack of caring that dominates his coworkers. The compassionate newly graduated students have already quit. The ones who care couldn't handle the state of the system. With broken hearts and spirits, they have quit their caregiving careers to go to work in the carpet mill. So now, instead of giving their loving care to the elderly, locked in these hell holes, they're breathing the chemicals of the carpet factory. My brother is hanging in there. He took all of the shifts available and is working through the entire Christmas weekend. He will be like a Christmas angel to the residents of that home, but he too may be quitting soon after. His co-worker is working with a wrist brace on her arm. She sprained her arm in a fight with her husband and son. She hit them so hard that she sprained her wrist. My brother witnessed two abusive situations between this woman and the clients of the home. He truthfully reported one infraction when asked, and that was then relayed to the abusive woman. And now my brother feels threatened by this co-worker and is feeling uneasy. This brother of mine, having lived in red states for the last 20 years, has given up on political cures long ago. He lived on the lovely Gulf of Florida coast and watched it be destroyed by BP. And so he moved to Alabama. I lived in Santa Cruz, California, one of the most progressive spots in the U.S. I urged him to vote and follow the political scene. We've had conflicts on this subject over the years when he would say, no, it's over. I continue to be a fighter, and I've been out there on street corners and in marches with my signs. Don't invade Iraq. Down with Citizens United. Occupy Wall Street. Watching the farce of the Republicans trying to find a candidate and the Democrats continuing to cave on the important issues, I started to see it through his eyes. I thought of him as negative and a defeatist at times, but hell, the voting machines don't count votes anymore, and most of the politicians have sold out completely to the highest bidder. Living in dark blue states for all my life, I've always wondered why people would vote Republican against their own interests. He made it clear to me, they're dumb as doorknobs. Like I said, my nature is to be the one on the Titanic, on the sinking Titanic, chewing bubble gum as hard as I can, and then shove it into the cracks in hopes of saving the ship. Every little bit helps, right? If I wasn't doing that, what would I be doing? Facing reality? We're all going to drown? I think I'm seeing a truth that I don't want to see, and I don't know what to do with it. It's a foreign thing to me, but I might just stop chewing the bubble gum and see what happens. I'll just save my breath for the coming ice age because every little bit helps. Kathy from Kauai. Now, when I read that, you know, I didn't know, I wasn't quite sure. And at one point, there's some optimism. The other point, there's some negativism. Or pessimism. I don't know. I just know when I got the email, I just thought, I think anybody could, who's been politically active could, and you know, in the working class could probably write something like this, having experienced it. I know it's very close to some of the feelings that I have felt. So I guess that's the reason I shared it with you. Kathy from Kauai, thank you very much. We'll be right back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Republican, baby, I can't stand those Republican. Fight the old Republican Party. Their self-esteem is high. They feel no obligation. They put their faith and trust in God and corporations. They stand for piety that doesn't suffer.
It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour, and once again, this hour has been sponsored by a longtime supporter of this program, Diana in Florida. Thanks, Diana. And her message is, it is class warfare, and the rich have been waging it against us since the beginning of civilization, always forgetting the danger that we vastly outnumber them. Thank you, Diana. Where was I? I guess it really doesn't matter, not on this program. Oh, did you catch the latest? I've seen this story floating around, but it was only today. And by the way, that email I just shared with you, it was written before Christmas. I just got around to it. That's why the references were to upcoming Christmas. But this one, the Montana State Supreme Court has held that the Citizens United ruling does not apply to Montana campaign finance law. Whoa, really? So a slap in the face to the U.S. Supreme Court. Good for you, Montana Supreme Court. Last Friday, the Montana Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of a 1912 voter initiative in their state. It was called the Corrupt Practices Act. That act prohibited corporations from making contributions to or expenditures on behalf of state political candidates and political parties. A century later, in 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a similar federal prohibition was unconstitutional, which prompted a wave of bills and court rulings that erased prohibitions on corporate and union political expenditures around the country. They always add that union part, right? Oh, yeah. Unions really corrupt the process, don't they? Yeah! The Attorney General of Montana, Steve Bullock, said in a statement after the ruling of the Montana Supreme Court, quote, for over 100 years, Montana has had an electoral system that preserves the integrity of the political process, encourages full participation, and safeguards against corruption. The Montana Supreme Court's decision upholds that system and is truly a victory for all Montanans. Do you understand what's going on here? This sets up a real battle coming. Somebody, one of the aggrieved parties, where are they? They're the typical people that you would think. Oh, the three plaintiffs who sued to roll back Montana's election law limiting campaign contributions are, first, a sole proprietor painting business, second, an influential Montana gun rights organization, and third, an out-of-state advocacy group. The advocacy group is Western Tradition Partnership, which has renamed itself American Tradition Partnership. And according to its website, it is dedicated to fighting environmental extremism and promoting responsible development and management of land, water, and natural resources, end quote. You know what that means. What do you want to bet that ATP is a front group, one of those astroturf groups set up by the gas, the timber, and the coal industries? They usually are. Anyway, ATP Executive Director Donald Ferguson said, quote, the Montana Supreme Court, through this decision, has shown contempt for the overriding law of the land and has thumbed its nose at the United States Supreme Court, which specifically held that the state of Montana has no interest in prohibiting people who associate together from speaking. Oh, my God. So, this will be the first test case for the U.S. Supreme Court to revisit its Citizens United decision. And we'll see what happens when they go back to it. The plaintiffs here, these three individuals who, possibly two of them are front groups for the oil, timber, and coal industries. They have until March 29th to seek review by the U.S. Supreme Court. But, you know, a round of applause to the Montana Supreme Court for invalidating within the state borders of Montana this Supreme Court ruling. So if you're going to run for office between now and March, we don't know what will happen if the Supreme Court rules on this. But I love to see this right-wing Supreme Court get smacked across the goddamn face by, you know, too bad the Florida Supreme Court didn't do this on December 9th, 2000, when the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that the vote counting had to stop. Too bad the Florida Supreme Court said, kiss our collective asses, we're going to go ahead and count the votes and see who won the election. But they didn't. And that's why we are where we are today, tonight. So kudos to the Montana State Supreme Court for saying to the fascists on the U.S. Supreme Court, no, not here, not now. We are going to run our elections without the corruption as best as we can prevent it of the influence of corporate money. At least they're taking a stand, huh? All right, stick around. We have a break here. When we come back, we are going to... strip some bark off this phony bastard Rick Santorum. I swear to God, this guy.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm from blue-collar family. My dad was a coal miner up there in Pennsylvania.
Oh, really? That makes you what, Rick? What does that make you? Santorum, who, you know, he's this election cycle's Huckabee. You remember the Christian fundamentalist freak, former governor of Arkansas, who won the, or came in very, what, first or second, I don't know, in the Iowa caucuses 4 years ago, 3 years ago. Whatever happened to Huckabee? Is he still on Fox? Yeah, well, that's where Santorum hopefully will wind up. We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. The Malloy program. Rick Santorum is just becoming a huge burr under my saddle. He really is. Sanctimonious halfwits are never well tolerated here on the Malloy program, but this guy is beyond belief. His latest, according to one of his latest, according to Crooks and Liars, is that marriage prevents poverty. Unless you're gay. Santorum says that everyone but gay men and lesbians can stay out of poverty if they just get married. Yeah, that's what he said. At a campaign event in Muscatine, Iowa, last Thursday, a guy asked Santorum how his anti-poverty plan would help the gays who can't legally marry in 45 states. Santorum has said, citing a Brookings Institution study back in 2009, Santorum said if you graduate from high school, you get married before you have children, and of course you work, you do those three things, there's only a 2% chance you'll be in poverty. Now, end quote, Rick Santorum. I don't know about the Brookings Institution study, I have no idea, but that's what he said. And then he went on to say, it's important to value the institution of marriage, because the institution of marriage is where men and women bond together for the purpose of having and raising children and giving children their birthright, which is a mom and a dad. That's their birthright? Really? Okay, we'll let that stand. And he goes on, and so what we need to have is a society that promotes that marriage, because that has an intrinsic value that is better than every other relationship. where to begin on this. If, on the one hand, Rick Santorum cites, and therefore he must believe, a study that says marriage is a stabilizing factor, it is an anti-poverty program, and it's good for kids, and yet he wants to rule out perhaps 20-25% of the population who happen to be gay and simply want to have the right to form a contract. Now, you know, I've never seen Santorum or any of these right-wing halfwits get their bowels in an uproar because two men form a contract about, say, insurance. I have an insurance agent. He will come to my house. He will make me an offer. I will make a counteroffer. We'll go through columns and numbers, and we finally reach an agreement. And this other man and I sign a contract. Santorum doesn't get upset about that. And then the contract becomes valid once he and I, not just the signing, but once something of value has been exchanged. So I give him money for the first 6 months' premium. That man and I just formed a contract. I don't hear Santorum screeching his bowels out about that. So if two men decide to form another kind of contract, one that says they can now jointly file federal tax returns, they can transfer property, they can receive Social Security survival benefits and all sorts of other things like buy insurance. What's the difference, Rick? You creepy goddamn religious fanatic. What's the difference? I wonder how many times Rick Santorum has formed a contract with another man. I wonder how many times his wife has formed a contract with another woman. I mean, there's an implied contract every time Rick Santorum's wife, assuming she does, goes to have her hair done. Now, regardless of what Santorum and allegedly the Brookings Institute has said about you only have a 2% chance that you'll be in poverty if you graduate from high school, get married before you have children, and, of course, work. Well, Jesus, I think it's that third one, Rick, that really makes all the difference in the world. If you work, if you have a job. But that's all right. That's all right. Okay, let's assume that the Brookings Institute and Rick Santorum are absolutely 100% correct. Well, then what about a recent study by the Economic Policy Institute? They issued a report that said the following, quote, continually high poverty rates among blacks and Latinos are the result of high unemployment and incarceration rates and declining shares of good jobs in the American economy. The decline in marriage among these groups is a collateral consequence of these other negative economic conditions. See what Santorum, end quote, what Santorum leaves out. Let's get all primitive on you here, okay? Man approaches a woman and says, hey, let's get married. The woman looks at the man and says to herself, what kind of economic security am I going to have here? Is this dude going to be able to take care of babies we might have? Is he going to be able to fight off the saber-toothed tigers and the Republicans? Is he going to take care of me? And if the man who just asked the woman to be his wife doesn't meet certain criteria that she has already established in her head. This is very primitive stuff. This goes all the way back to cave people. So, you know, you accept this for what it's worth. Okay. If she looks at him and decides, well, he's a black man in America. That means he has probably a 70% chance he's going to go to prison. He's a Latino man in America, which means there's a good chance he's going to be stopped so many times and asked for identification. He may go insane. He is a person of color in America, a man of color, which means he's going to be last hired and first fired. No thanks, I don't want to get married. So, what the Economic Policy Institute is saying very, very clearly and precisely, regardless of the right-wing rhetorical bullcrap that Santorum puts out there, people do not get married in order to stay out of poverty. People get married because they happen to fall in love. Man, woman, woman, and decide, hey, let's make a contract. Now, sometimes in a man, woman, woman, man situation, the woman may look at the man and decide whether or not he's a good economic choice. The man may look at the woman and try to decide if the ratio between her breasts and her hips are sufficient to have children. These things happen, truth seekers. So if Rick Santorum is a great advocate of marriage, then get the hell out of the way, you freak. Gay folk have no interest in being married in a mosque, a church, a temple, or a synagogue that doesn't want to sanctify their marriage, but that's not where marriage is made legal. It's made legal by a county courthouse. It's made legal by state law. It's not made legal, Rick, because of some fading, half-witted, sanctimonious, religious bigot like you. So, if you do those three things, graduate high school, get married yet before you have children, and of course work, there's only a 2% chance you'll be in poverty. Well, Rick, then, why don't you do everything in your power to make sure that every American has a chance at that? Huh? Improve the education system. Get your ass out of the way of people forming a marriage contract, no matter what their gender identity is. And third, do your best, Rick, to make sure that people have jobs in this country. Then open your sanctimonious, flapping mouth.
Somebody singing a soft tune. Two men died neath the Mississippi moon. Somebody better investigate soon.
Santorum. One thing that I think people need to keep in mind, I've heard commentators talk about this, and nobody in this field of Republican dolts seems able to get anywhere where it concerns taking a lead. Not Romney, not Santorum, not Ron Paul, none of them. But I think progress tracked Santorum throughout the months of his campaigning through Iowa's 99 counties, and they compiled a list of his top 10 most outrageous claims. Here they are. Number one, he would annul all same-sex marriages. Are you aware of this? He has argued the gay relationships destabilize society. The sick son of a bitch. No, they don't. Rick, I'll tell you what destabilizes society. War, poverty, capitalism, but never mind. He would not offer any legal protections to gay relationships, and he's pledged to annul all same-sex marriages if elected president. You see, this is the dictatorial fascist part of him. Marriages are not decided on a federal level. They're decided on a state level and all the way down to counties, right? But he is going to annul all same-sex marriages if elected president. He's really fixated on this, and I think the reason is something inside Rick that desperately wants to be let out. That's all I can think of. During his 99-county tour of Iowa, he frequently compared same-sex relationships to inanimate objects like trees, basketballs, beer, paper towels, even tried to blame the economic crisis on gay folk. He tried to explain back in August that religious people have a constitutional right to discriminate against gay people. He said that. He said, quote, "We have a right, the constitution of religious liberty. But now the courts have created a super right that's above a right that's actually in the constitution, and that's of sexual liberty. And I think that's a wrong, destructive element." What? What? What the hell is he talking about? Like most people fixated on somebody else's crotch, this man is out of his goddamn mind. Rick, stick to hetero porn, okay? And let gay folk alone. Or I guess you watch hetero porn. I don't know, maybe you don't. Number two, he's for income inequality. He's for income inequality. Santorum said during an event in Pella, Iowa in December, quote, "I think some people should make more money than other people because some people work harder and have better ideas and take more risk, and they should be rewarded for it. I have no problem with income inequality." You kind of miss the point, you half-wit. You really do. Oh, well. Three, Contraception is a, quote, "license to do things," end quote. Santorum has pledged to repeal all federal funding for contraception and allow the states to outlaw birth control. He insisted that, quote, "it's a license to do things in a sexual realm that is counter to how things are supposed to be. I'm supposed to be on top. And keep your mouth away from, you know, my man parts." All right, I added that last, but he did say it's a license to do things in a sexual realm that is counter to how things are supposed to be. Oh, my God. Number four, gay soldiers cause problems for people living in close quarters. During an appearance on Fox News on a Sunday in October, Santorum defended his support for Don't Ask, Don't Tell by arguing that gay soldiers would disrupt the military because, quote, "they're in close quarters. They live with people. They obviously shower with people." Do you get that? He also suggested that, quote, "there are people who were gay and lived the gay lifestyle and aren't anymore." The gay lifestyle. Is that like the evangelical Christian right-wing heterosexual screwed up necrophiliac lifestyle, Rick? Oh, well. Number six, we don't need food stamps because obesity rates are too high. I'm just going to leave that one alone. Number seven, abortion exceptions to protect women's health are, quote, phony. Phony. There is no such thing as an abortion to protect the life and health of the mother. It doesn't exist, to Rick Santorum. Number eight, health reform will kill my child. Santorum, who claims that so-called Obamacare motivated him to run for president, told reporters in April that his daughter Bella, who was born with a genetic abnormality, wouldn't survive in a country with, quote, socialized medicine, end quote. He said, children like my Bella are not given the treatment that other children are given, end quote. Maybe not by you. What do you see your daughter Bella's birth as, Rick? A curse from God? Is that how you see it? Of course you do. It's a burden laid on you by your master, the Lord. You're being tested like Job, right, Rick? You sick freak. When we come back, I'm going to tell you about Rick Santorum and his wife's abortion. Stay with us.
America one flying monkey at a time. Here's Mike Malloy.
Back to some more Romney here. We had eight of his most outrageous claims, eight of ten. Number nine, uninsured Americans should spend less of their money on cell phone bills. Yeah, okay. Answering a question about uninsured people, Santorum explained that health care, like a car, is a luxury resource. Health care is a luxury that is rationed by society. And he recalled the story of a woman who said she was spending $200 a month on life-saving prescriptions. Santorum told her to stop complaining and instead lower her cable and cell phone bills. Wouldn't you like to just get this guy and really have a chat with him? And number 10, insurers should discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. They should. Santorum, according to Crooks and Liars, sounded like a representative from the health insurance industry, which he is, when he addressed a small group of high school students in December. Santorum not only defended insurers for denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, he also argued that individuals who are sick should pay higher premiums because they cost more money to insure. Isn't this sanctimonious son of a bitch who stands up there and surrounds himself with his 37 children and his ever faithful wife and talks about how, he's another one that said God told him to run. How many of these people, God is really screwing up. God told Cain to run. God told Perry to run. God told Michelle Bachman to run. God's having a terrible time, isn't he? Huh? What's wrong with this God? What's wrong with him? Santorum. I don't know if we have time to get into this, but I'll try it. This is from OurSilverRibbon.org. It's a woman's website, political site, blog site. Rick Santorum is one dangerously confused denialist. He is best known for his inability to associate his professed compassion for life at the level of the zygote and the physical realities of human sexuality. He has equated loving same-sex relationships to bestiality. He is opposed to abortion under any circumstance. Almost. In October 1996, his wife Karen had a second trimester abortion. They don't like to describe it that way. In his 2004 interview with Terry Gross on public radio, Santorum characterizes the fetus, who must be treated as an autonomous person, as a practically practically a gunslinging threat whom the mother must murder in self-defense. Karen has had to justify her decision to save her own life by explaining that if she died, her other children would have lost a mother. Republican extremists in Congress and the state houses proposed to make abortion illegal, even if it would save the mother's life. And even the Santorums admit they would make that choice while claiming that they didn't. Losing a pregnancy because of a fatal fetal anomaly is never cause for celebration. The pain of second trimester abortion is compounded by the hateful hypocrites who vilify families facing sorrowful circumstances and the resulting scarcity of abortion clinicians. It is revolting that Rick and Karen Santorum choose to stigmatize and harass those of us who, as they did, grieve over the loss of a possible child in the second trimester. Abortion should not be driving U.S. policy. It's not a more fundamental right than the right to a job or safety from violence. But we can't stop it from being used as a wedge issue if we never talk about our experiences. Here's the Santorum's description of their second trimester abortion, written by Steve Goldstein of the Philadelphia Inquirer, May 4th, 1997. Karen was in her 19th week of pregnancy. Husband and wife were in a suburban Virginia office for a routine sonogram when a radiologist told them that the fetus Karen was carrying had a fatal defect and was going to die. After consulting with specialists who offered several options, including abortion, the Santorums decided on long-shot intrauterine surgery to correct an obstruction of the urinary tract called posterior urethral valve syndrome. A few days later, a rare bladder shunt surgery was performed at Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia. The incision in the womb carried a high risk of infection. 2 days later, at home in the Pittsburgh suburb of Verona, Karen Santorum became feverish. Her Philadelphia doctors instructed her to hurry to Pittsburgh's McGee Women's Hospital, which has a unit specializing in high-risk pregnancies. After examining Karen, who was nearly incoherent with a 105-degree fever, a doctor at the hospital led Santorum into the hallway outside her room and said that she had an intrauterine infection and some type of medical intervention was necessary. Unless the source of the infection, the fetus, was removed from Karen's body, she would likely die. At minimum, the doctor said, Karen had to be given antibiotics intravenously or she might go into septic shock and die. The Santorums were at a crossroads. Once they agreed to use antibiotics, they believed they were committing to delivery of the fetus, which they knew would most likely not survive outside the womb. Santorum said, quote, the doctor said they were talking about a matter of hours or a day or two before risking sepsis, and both of them might die. Obviously, Santorum said, it was a choice of whether both Karen and the child are going to die or just the child is going to die. I mean, that's a pretty easy call, end quote. Shivering under heated blankets in McGee's labor and delivery unit as her body tried to reject the source of the infection, Karen felt cramping from early labor. Santorum agreed to start his wife on intravenous antibiotics to, quote, buy her some time, end quote, he said. The antibiotics brought Karen's fever down. The doctor suggested a drug to accelerate her labor. The cramps were labor, and she was going to get into more active labor, Santorum said. Karen said, quote, we're not inducing labor. That's an abortion. No way. That isn't going to happen. I don't care what happens, end quote. As her fever subsided, Karen, a former neonatal intensive care nurse, asked for something to stop the labor. Her doctors refused, Santorum recalled, citing malpractice concerns. Santorum said her labor proceeded without having to induce an abortion. Karen, a soft-spoken, red-haired 37-year-old, said that ultimately she would have agreed to intervention for the sake of her other children. She said, quote, if the physician came to me and said, if we don't deliver your baby in 1 hour, you will be dead, yeah, I would have to do it. But for me, it was at the very end. I would never make a decision like that until all other means had been thoroughly exhausted, end quote. The fetus was delivered at 20 weeks, at least a month shy of what most doctors consider viability. In the months after the birth and death of Gabriel Michael Santorum, rumors began circulating in the Pennsylvania medical community that Karen Santorum had undergone an abortion. These rumors found their way to the Inquirer, prompting the questions that led to this article. Santorum said of the rumors, quote, there are a lot of people who aren't big fans of Rick Santorum. You're a public figure and you're out there. Maybe it accomplishes a political purpose. Now, you can make your own decision regarding what I just shared with you from the Inquirer. Now, this was the fetus that Santorum had, I want to say pickled, but I guess that wouldn't be the right word, would it? They wrapped this dead fetus up. They took it home where the Santorums, according to them, fondled it, kissed it, talked to it, had their children do the same, gave it a name, introduced it to the other children. I realize there are death cults all over this planet. I understand that. But this is so far out there as to render the whole thing just a nightmarish quality that I cannot get my mind around. I just can't see even somebody as crazed, a religious nut as Rick Santorum, taking the corpse of a fetus that had to be aborted. It had to be. They could have stopped the labor. They decided not to. Spontaneous abortion. Call it whatever you want. But as Karen Santorum said, if it had come down to a choice, which it did, between her and the baby, as they called it, dying, or her surviving and the fetus dying because of her other children, there was no contest. She knew what choice she would make. But isn't that all that every single woman is making? Let me. Or isn't that what they're all demanding? Let me make the choice. Give me the private sphere where I can sit down with my doctor, with my partner, and make a decision that Karen and Rick Santorum reserve for themselves, but nobody else. Because, well, like gay marriage, somehow it will rip the fabric of society, right?
Is sure enough getting worse. Everybody's crying just as long as there's business first.
10 before the hour. And by the way, the
touch and go.
The lead, the websites where the information about Rick Santorum and Karen Santorum's abortion, second trimester abortion, occurred. Those websites were turned on, were sent to me by Kay, using Senator Santorum's vocabulary. His wife Karen had a quote partial birth abortion end quote. And as Kay points out, the hypocrisy meter just melted down due to Republican overload. It's just astonishing. And as far as those 10 things that Santorum has said, you know, regarding health insurance and so on and so forth, you know, he's entitled to lifetime, I believe, health insurance because he was a senator. I think he was a representative before that, wasn't he? He went as a representative way back in 94 in the great Republican Revolution. So Santorum gets his health insurance paid for by you and me. But he doesn't want anyone else to have health insurance paid for by you and me. See, if we had socialized health insurance, not socialized medicine, there's a difference. If we had a socialized health insurance system, single payer, government, whatever you want to call it, then you and I would be paying for you and I to have procedures done or examinations conducted or tests made or healthy lifestyles encouraged, you know, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, that sort of thing. Watch out. And Bruce writes in, Santorum spent a year in Iowa pandering to every church group that would open the door, but got nowhere with his homophobia because Iowa has had so-called gay marriage for a couple of years and the corn didn't shrivel and die. His surge at the last minute happened only because he was the last not Romney left standing. Even though Romney and his dark money pack spent millions, he got less votes than in 2008. Even Republicans realized the same old crap isn't going to work. And they keep casting about for that imaginary Republican that has all the answers. As soon as the newest, not Romney, speaks, that would be Santorum, the realization sets in that he too is a Republican, and lacking any answers. From Bruce, a.k.a. Prairie 2. In my pantheon of the types, the personality types that I despise the most, if you're a listener to this program, regular listener, you know, right up there at the top are hypocrites. I can't stand hypocrites. And just about every religious text ever put together pretty much states the same thing, that hypocrisy... I think even Dante reserved one of the lower rings of hell for hypocrites. But hypocrites, liars, cheats, sneaks, in other words, your typical Republican. Your typical Democrat is sometimes also a hypocrite, a liar. But I can't take the sanctimonious types. I just can't. Remember David Frum, who was a George W. Bush speechwriter and advisor? He had a bit in New York Magazine. Not New Yorker, but New York Magazine. I think last month. It's a lengthy piece, but just a couple of sentences here. Under the headline, "When did the GOP lose touch with reality?" You gotta love that, right, David? I've been a Republican all my adult life. I've worked on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. I've worked at Forbes magazine, at the Manhattan and American Enterprise Institute, as a speechwriter for George W. Bush. I believe in free markets, low taxes, reasonable regulation, and limited government. I voted for John McCain in 2008, and I have strongly criticized the major policy decisions of the Obama administration. But as I contemplate my party and my movement in 2011, I see things I simply cannot support. Really, David? That must be hell. You know, there are, believe it or not, contrary to what I've said many times on this program, and you know that... A goodly part of this program is devoted to hyperbole and overstatement. Really? Yes. There are a few intelligent Republicans. They may be psychotic where it concerns their political point of view, but they do have gray matter that is used for more than just figuring out ways to prevent folks from making marriage contracts. There are some intelligent, using the Sanford-Binet, is that the test? That's one of them. Is it Sanford or Stanford? Stanford-Binet IQ test. Is that what it's called? There are some Republicans who will score quite well on that. And those are the ones who are losing their minds. From Herman Cain to Rick Santorum. Are you kidding me? From Herman Cain? And in there, Rick Perry, who is still standing. Not really. He's out. He's gone. Bachman's gone. Kane's gone. Huntsman's on his way out. I mean, come on. Gingrich? He's so last century. Oh, my God. All right, stick around. I want to talk to you coming up next hour about an issue that is going to become one of the key issues that the Republicans are going to use against Obama. It's something that he is trying to work out with the Taliban. Stick around. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. So, yeah, I think I mentioned this earlier tonight. Tim in Decatur, Alabama, had a good idea last night after watching the Dog and Pony Show. And haven't the announcements been so interesting today, especially Bachman's? Oh, my God. Anyway, Tim in Decatur, Alabama, wrote, I think it was, yeah, last night. No, I guess it was early this morning. That's right. Tim writes, well, even though they don't want careful counting and documentation of other people's votes, the Republicans make sure Iowa is accurate enough to determine a 4-vote margin. There should now be no further discussion, Tim writes. All elections should be hand-marked and publicly counted. This proves it can be done. All of the Diebold ESS crap machines should be sent to Las Vegas for repurposing as gambling machines. And the crooks who sold this bill of goods, touchscreen, no paper trail, should have to answer to criminal charges. Well, Tim, I thoroughly agree with that. Yeah, isn't it? And the other thing, of course, from last night, we mentioned earlier, nobody who showed up at those caucuses to vote had to show any kind of photo ID. I wonder how many illegal aliens were in there voting. I mean, Iowa's a farm state, right? A lot of undocumented workers still there. Everybody, you know, when it's time to harvest the genetically altered food that a lot of these farmers now plant, who do they hire? They don't hire American citizens. They can't. American citizens says no thanks. So I just wonder how many undocumented foreigners were in that crowd last night. There's no way of knowing because the Republicans did not require photo ID. They did not require their people to operate some little ESS or Diebold machine with proprietary programs inside to determine where the vote really goes. Tim in Alabama is absolutely right. Paper ballots, hand count them. Did you watch that last night? 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, with interested parties standing watching the vote counted. 45, 46, 47, 48, 49. Right? So easy. Isn't that easy? Regarding the Republicans, I don't want to talk about this stuff. I really don't. I just don't. But Bradley Burstyn, who is an expat American, lives in Israel, and he writes for Haaretz newspaper. Haaretz is, relatively speaking, the liberal newspaper in Israel. And Bradley Burstyn had a piece in Haaretz, I think it was yesterday. And he writes about how every 4 years he watches from a distance as America turns into a foreign country. He's talking about the voting, the primary season. And he says at this distance, it often seems that the world's most eccentric candidate selection process will force the U.S. clear off the rails. Eccentric candidate selection process. Yeah, no kidding. And then Burstyn writes, thank God for Ron Paul. Now, let me just tell you, he's being, ironic here. So please understand that. He says, in a wider sense, Dr. Paul just might be what the Republican Party needs. And along with it, what the United States needs. Not, God forbid, as president, rather as a sobering influence. A cautionary plunge of madness. An immensely valuable bad dream. Oh, I think Ron Paul is all those things. A bad dream. a plunge of madness, a sobering influence if America pays attention. I really do. Anyway, Bradley goes on to say, in fact, so outrageous an object lesson is the presidential candidacy of the gynecologist from Galveston, Texas, that there are those of us who could use a man like Ron Paul here in Israel right about now. What he's referring to, of course, is the insanity of the Israeli right, the Likudniks, the party of Benjamin Netanyahu. They're as insane as the Republicans in this country, right? Bradley Burstyn goes on, what the Ron Paul phenomenon can teach Israelis about themselves, in particular, Benjamin Netanyahu's Republican-allied Likud party, is what Republicans themselves have discovered to their horror in recent weeks and months. Here is a man, Ron Paul, who scares the bejesus out of the Republican establishment, and not a moment too soon. At long last, the party of Lincoln is waking in the back seat of a long, careening, drunk drive that is Tea Party extremism. Ooh, Bradley! He goes on. Moderate Republicans, many of whom had quietly prayed that support for Paul would quickly dry up and blow away, have watched aghast as the Texas congressman's bandwagon has gathered momentum of late. They have gone from pointedly ignoring Ron Paul to studying his views, which are radically at odds with both most Republicans and with the swing voters who may well decide the November presidential election. Of course, it may turn out that the lessons of all this may be lost on precisely those Israelis who have the most to gain from learning from the extremism in the United States, is what Bradley's talking about. He gives some examples here. Number one, ignore extremists at your peril. You should never ignore extremists. Giving extremists room to maneuver in a national stage can backfire badly, tying your hands even as it tars you with a wide brush. Number two, tolerate extremism and you breed competition in the extremism arena, which breeds escalation. Of course.
It's Mike Malloy.
Reagan. You know, I mentioned last night that Reagan had you know, he was not the iconic, he is an iconic figure, but everything that the Republicans ever said about him pretty much is a lie. Reagan was not what the Republicans had portrayed him to be. He may have been, he may have become their iconic figure, but let me give you an example. Prairie 2 sent this in to me last night after I had mentioned something about Reagan's tax increases and how much debt Reagan saddled the country with. Bruce writes, Ronald Reagan doubled the debt and then doubled that amount. He presided over 11 tax increases, mostly on the middle class, whose taxes he doubled, although he did raise capital gains tax to head off a Great Depression during his administration. The Republicans have insisted that this tax needs to go to zero. A Great Depression, you see, is their friend. To quote Hoover, Secretary of the Treasury, quote, depressions return the wealth to the people that it belongs to, end quote. That would be the rich. Reagan not only doubled Social Security taxes and federal excise taxes on stuff like tires, airline tickets, etc., but he shifted costs to the states that tripled the sales tax and property taxes and allowed corporations to force states and municipalities to subsidize them at the expense of actual taxpayers who no longer get the services they pay for. Reagan, the great hero, the man who, I mentioned the other night, it took the entire history of the United States from before we were a country up until the end of the Carter administration to accumulate $1 trillion in debt. It took Ronald Reagan just, 2 years, 3 years to double it, and then, as Prairie 2 points out, to double it again. There is your great communicator, your great tax cutter. Have I mentioned yet tonight how much I hate these Republicans? They make me so sick. It is Wednesday, isn't it? This is supposed to be church night. Here's something somebody sent me. What is this? The USA lies in complete moral ruin. Despite the exertions of 10,000 evangelical preachers in dusty back road tilt-up chapels from Texas to the Carolinas, several new museums of creation science, and the shining example of former Senator Rick Santorum. Just look at how we behave. From the cloakrooms of Congress to the piercing parlors of West Hollywood to the 7-Elevens of suburban Maryland. Where did this come from? But isn't that the truth? You would think with all the emphasis that these crazed, phlegm-encrusted, right-wing, spewing evangelical preachers that with their vast number constantly all leading us from the paths of non-righteousness into the comfort of their of their congregations, where they can then relieve us of our burden, which would be our money. Well, not me, not you, but a lot of people. You would think that at some point they could declare themselves the winner. What is it? Is Satan that powerful? It must be. I keep going back to what's his name? Robertson said last night that after lengthy conversations with God, Pat Robertson knows who the next president is going to be. Yeah, he does. And he's not going to talk about it. God told him, hush up now, Pat. If you say who it is, I'll bring you home. And, you know, you don't want to come home, because coming home means you have to go through the valley of the shadow of death. And in your case, Pat, you're going to get lost. And the golems are going to jump out of the darkness and rend your flesh and tear you into a million pieces. So, Pat, I'll tell you who the winner's going to be, but you have to keep it to yourself. And, of course, Pat was, come on, God, for God's sake. Come on. Let me tell my flock of morons. No, you can't tell them. Okay, God, you know, whatever you say. Valley of the Shadow of Death? These people are insane. All right, right after the break, I'm going to tell you what is going to be the newest talking point for these Republican crazy candidates through the balance, or a good portion of the rest of the political season. One of the big major talking points that will be proof positive to anyone who wants to pay attention that Barack Obama is a communist, socialist, Muslim-loving, Taliban-respecting, foreign-born freak who wants to turn all of our children gay. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
he just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. So, I wonder how long it'll be before this is worked into these crazed Nazi-like Republicans as they go after the crazed fascist-like corporatist Barack Obama to do what the Republican Party has vowed to do, and that is to make Barack Obama one-term president. No matter how badly the country may suffer as a result of that effort, it doesn't make any difference to Republicans. They're out to destroy the country and to turn it over to the people who own them. And those are the corporatists, the capitalists. This is a full-scale run of madness. We all know this. I think the only thing that keeps us sane, or the one thing that will drive us insane, it's a dichotomy here, is to continue to talk about this. There's so many nights where I would just much rather, switch the whole focus of this program over to something like, what Stephanie Miller does, maybe. But, to try to retain what little shreds of sanity I've still got left, and they are getting fewer and fewer. You ever feel that way? Do you ever sit, just before you turn on this program, do you ever think, I don't know if I want to listen to him tonight? Did you ever do that, right? I do that every night. I don't know if I want to sit down and go through this again. Oh, my God. But I digress. In this madness now that will that's about to ensue, the real madness, as the Republican field of halfwits shakes itself out, Bachman's gone, Perry's gone. Who's next? I think Newt will soon disappear. Huntsman will be gone. Who else? It's getting down to this three-headed clown act of Santorum. He's not going to last too much longer. Romney, Ron Paul, Ron Paul, who is beyond berserk. A lot of people say young people, I think, are being very conned. A lot of young people say, well, I really like Ron Paul because the libertarian wants to do away with the drug laws, wants to disengage us from our military adventurism around the planet, wants to reduce the military to a real homeland security force. That's what libertarianism is all about. And not all about, but that's one of the main focuses. But Ron Paul and libertarianism is a false kind of governance. It's nonsense. Modern libertarianism, it's Ayn Randism. It's economic Darwinism. It takes people who are unable for whatever reason, innocent children, innocent old people, innocent people in between children and old people, and kicks them to the street. You want to know who the best libertarian is? It's not Ron Paul. The best libertarian are those people who have made billions and millions and millions of dollars, and all of a sudden they're saying, hey, we don't need any of this rules and regulations crap. Ron Paul would abolish every single federal agency that is designed. I'm not saying they're all functioning the way they should, but is designed. Every agency that's designed to erect a wall between you and the most predatory aspects of capitalism. Ron Paul would tear them all down. He would let the market decide. If too many people die from eating poisoned lettuce leaves, well, eventually people will stop eating lettuce leaves produced by the company that poisons them. That's the theory of libertarianism. The market rules. But, of course, that is a ridiculous argument because you don't know where the lettuce leaves are coming from. It doesn't make any difference what company puts them in a bag. That's where the government has to step in. Regulatory agencies that say, give us a sample of your lettuce leaves. Oh, God, never mind. There's no point in getting screamy about this, Malloy. Come on. So anyway, one of the arrows in the quiver of these Republican trolls now is going to be the fact that the Obama administration has agreed in principle to the release of high-ranking Taliban officials from Guantanamo Bay, from our torture prison camp in Cuba, in return for the Taliban's agreement to open a political office for peace negotiations in Qatar, the little Middle Eastern kingdom on the Arabian Peninsula. Now, this is all being reported by The Guardian of the UK. According to sources familiar with the talks, The Guardian says, in the U.S. and in Afghanistan, the handful of Taliban figures will include Mullah Khair Khawa, is that right? A former interior minister, and Nurullah Nuri, a former governor of northern Afghanistan. More controversially, though, the Taliban are demanding the release of the former army commander Mullah Fazl Akhund. I'm sorry. And the Obama administration is reported to be considering formally handing him over to the custody of another country, possibly Qatar. The releases would be to reciprocate for yesterday's announcement from the Taliban that they are prepared to open a political office in Qatar to conduct peace negotiations, quote, with the international community, end quote. That's, you know, code speak for with the Americans and the NATO people who are bombing the bejesus out of our country. Now, according to the experts, this is the most significant political breakthrough in 10 years of our bombing and being killed and killing and destroying Afghanistan. You know, and you got to ask yourself, why are we still there? Didn't we murder, what's his name? What was his name? The guy who, oh yeah, now I remember. It just got away from me. Osama bin Laden. So, why are we, well, I don't know. But anyway, we continue to bomb and strafe and drone aircraft civilians by the scores, by the dozens, by the hundreds. And the Taliban, of course, being religious fanatics as they are the type of religious fanatics that the Christian fundamentalists in this country seek to emulate and to be exactly similar to. All right, poor construction on the sentence there, but you know what I'm saying. The Taliban, they've got it knocked, man. I mean, my God. First of all, they keep their women in these burqas. Girls and women are allowed no freedom, no sense of self, nothing. This is what the Christian right in this country wants. It's totally a patriarchal society. The men rule everything. They get to sit around and smoke opium and while the women do the work, as long as the women stay covered up, this is what the Christian right wants here. Instead of smoking opium, though, they'd be smoking leaves out of their Bibles. But it's basically the same thing. So the Christian right in this country, while they admire and honor the Taliban in Afghanistan, oh my God, I want to be like them. Ooh. Plus, you know, the multiple marriages and 13-year-old brides and so on and so forth. This is what the Christian right in this country lusts after. They want that kind of power and authority because their holy book tells them to do that. The Christian's holy book, the first half of it, instructs them to do that. So here's their chance to get behind Barack Obama's efforts now to negotiate with the Taliban to try to bring an end to this conflict. We've been there for 10 years trying to smash them into democracy. Isn't that wonderful? We are going to smash you goddamn people. We are going to break your cities. We're going to demolish everything about you because you're going to be democratic. Oh, that'll work. Yeah. So now, the Obama administration says, well, okay, let's talk. We'll free some of your people. You're holding one of ours, a 25-year-old sergeant captured in June 2009, an American soldier, a guy named Bo Bergdahl. It's not clear whether he would be freed as part of this deal. But according to an Obama administration advisor on the Afghan peace process until last year. This man said, quote, to take this step, the Obama administration has to have sufficient confidence that the Taliban are going to reciprocate. He said, this advisor said, it is going to be really risky. Guantanamo is a very sensitive issue politically, end quote. Now, you know what he means there. Oh, no, this guy is Avali Nazar. He is now a professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And he said that the Taliban announcement on the opening of an office in Qatar was a dramatic breakthrough. So what he's saying, this is going to be a risky, in a sense, a risky thing to do on the part of the Obama administration. And it's going to be a very sensitive issue politically. That means that the Republicans now have their issue. Don't you see? Barack Obama is going to release terrorists! Terrorists! He's going to release terrorists! Oh my God, we got to get him out of office!
Like I see through the water that runs down my drain. He fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion.
Before the hour. So, I don't know how you look at this. I feel a sense of relief that after 10 years, this is our longest war in history, isn't it? After 10 years, the government of the United States has either responded to or initiated some type of an agreement with the Taliban. Remember the Taliban, back when we were fighting by proxy the Russians in Afghanistan back in the late 80s, or early 80s, all through the 80s, the Taliban were our allies. We supported their suppression of women. We supported their tribalism. We supported their fundamentalist Muslim point of view. We supported their war against the Russian occupiers. And then we became the occupiers. And you've got to wonder why. Well, the argument was we had to invade Afghanistan because those were where the terrorist camps were set up that trained Al-Qaeda, and it was Al-Qaeda that had attacked the United States on September 11th. Of course, the funding came from Saudi Arabia, and the training on how to fly the aircraft, if you want to believe the official story, occurred in Minnesota and Florida and California. But Afghanistan, you see, was a very critical strategic area. It's where the American oil companies and energy companies wanted to run a pipeline from the Caspian Sea area, which is rich in oil and gas and oil, over Afghanistan to Karachi, Pakistan, is that the port? Because Afghanistan is landlocked, and then into the Indian Ocean, and everybody gets rich. Of course, that excludes the people of Afghanistan. Well, the mullahs in Afghanistan said, no, we don't want to do that. So they were invited to Houston, Texas, and they had a big chat down in Houston, and they were told, we will pave your streets with gold or we will carpet bomb you. And one of the people attending that meeting, of course, was Dick Cheney. And the Taliban still said no. The mullahs still said no. Well, you know what happened next. So we've had 10 years of warfare there. The lie, the filthy, disgusting lie fed to the American people was we were there to get rid of those terror camps, those training areas. The truth was we were there to secure the country of Afghanistan for the furtherance of American capitalism. And if that meant subduing the tribal chieftains, doesn't this sound familiar? This sounds like something that happened in the American West back in the early 19th century, doesn't it? Mid-19th century? Same thing. Different weaponry. So for 10 years now, we have been attempting to install democracy onto the tribal people of Afghanistan. It didn't work for Genghis Khan. It didn't work for Alexander the Great. It didn't work for the British. It didn't work for the Russians. And it's not going to work for us. So perhaps now, peace talks. Peace talks. The Taliban and the United States meeting in Qatar on the Arabian Peninsula, where we have a huge military force. Is it the 5th Fleet, the 6th Fleet? I'm not sure which one. It really doesn't matter. But we have an awful lot of boats over there, you know, with a lot of destructive power because of those, well, you know, those Iranians. This is madness. You notice how insane all of this is? It's just absolute madness. So Professor Nazar, Vali Nazar, who was an Obama administration advisor about Afghanistan, he's now a professor at Tufts University. He said this announcement by the Taliban the other day of opening an office in Qatar was a dramatic breakthrough. He said, quote, if it had not happened, then the idea of reconciliation would have been completely finished. The Qatar office is akin to the Taliban forming a Sinn Féin, a political wing, that was of the Irish Republican Army, to conduct negotiations. The next phase will need concessions on both sides. This doesn't mean we are now on autopilot to peace, end quote. Negotiations on both sides. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe because the United States has sunk a decade worth of blood, ours and theirs, and resources into Afghanistan for absolutely no reason. I defy anyone listening, even you right-wing trolls who hang back to see what the other side is talking about. Give me a reason, a rational reason. Wait a minute, am I using the word rational and I'm talking to right-wingers? Forget it. Let me address it to normal people who happen to be listening to this program. A rational explanation as to why. I said rational. We ever went to Afghanistan to begin with. After the attack on this country, a global police action was what was called for. Track down the perps who put it together. The 9 perps who pulled it off, was it 9? Were declared dead. If the story, the official story was correct, how could they have survived? Right? Even though, interestingly, some of them occasionally show up someplace, according to reports. I don't know, truth seekers. The point I'm trying to make, though, is that now the Republican trolls have their one of their central campaign issues. Barack Obama is going to negotiate with the Taliban. You know what's next? Sharia law in the United States. That's what's next. This is insane. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.